Like all others in Sunstone, is by registration only, and there's the registration desk out front. Lynn has also asked me to remind you that banquet tickets are on sale for will be on sale for 1 hour after this session, and then after that you'll no longer be able to purchase them. This session is entitled, or the paper you'll hear, this session given by Fred Voros. Is entitled Neo-Orthodox Mormonism, Progressive Mormonism, and the Personality of God. Fred Voros is married to Vicki Smith, and they are the parents of four children. Fred grew up on the central coast of California. He received his bachelor's and law degree at BYU and is now practicing in Salt Lake City at the firm of Poole & Voros. He's the author of Was the Book of Mormon Buried with King Follett? And Do You Believe in Magic? Why the 60s Generation is Losing Faith. He is a Sunday school teacher in his ward. And comments to his paper will be made by Carl Huntsaker, who is director of the Institute of Constructive Living and has published numerous articles in Sunstone. Fred?
I believe in grace, and for that reason I have been on occasion accused, falsely accused, of trying to smuggle Protestant doctrine, even Calvinist doctrine, into the church. But I'm not a Calvinist, and if I'd only had my camera with me on one occasion, I would have photographic proof of that. A couple of years ago, I was down in Las Vegas, and I met a young man in our conversation improbably turned to religion. He mentioned that he was a Reformed Presbyterian, and I had never heard that term before, but I analogized to Judaism and said, well, is that a more liberal branch of Presbyterianism, which I think of as a fairly liberal Protestant denomination anyway. He said, oh no, just the opposite, more traditional. He said, if John Calvin were to attend church in my church, he would feel totally comfortable with all the doctrine that's taught. And I said the same thing every one of you would have said, which was, do you mean you're a strict predestinarian? And he said that he was. He believed in predestination. So that's when I wanted a camera, so I could stand next to him and have somebody take a picture, and then later I would label it, you know, Calvinist, with an arrow pointing to him, and Mormon who believes in grace but also free will, pointing to me. And you know, the thing that made the story even more interesting to me was later on. I was walking through the casino, and he was sitting in front of a slot machine, you know, playing the slots. And I thought, isn't that incongruous that a predestinarian would be playing a game of chance? And I thought, no, not really. He probably thinks God predestined him to win a jackpot, you know. Anyway, I'm not a Calvinist. I'm not a Protestant. I'm a Neo-Orthodox Mormon, although that label is not one I would have chosen. It was affixed, regrettably in my view, but apparently unalterably, by Kendall White in a dialogue article and later in his provocative book, Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy, A Crisis Theology. There he identifies a strain of Mormonism that he analogizes to Protestant Neo-Orthodoxy. He defines this school of Mormonism by three doctrines: the concept of an absolute God, a pessimistic assessment of human nature, and a doctrine of salvation by grace. White contrasts Neo-Orthodoxy with what he calls traditional Mormonism, but is more accurately and fairly, I think, termed progressive Mormonism. Progressive Mormonism's counterparts to the trifold doctrines of Neo-Orthodoxy are a finite God, an optimistic assessment of human nature, and a doctrine of salvation by human merit. White's conclusions about Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy are drawn mostly from the writings of a cadre of BYU religion teachers in the 1960s. Unfortunately, the younger generation of Neo-Orthodox Mormons had published comparatively little by 1986, when his book was completed. Otherwise, he would not have linked Neo-Orthodoxy, I believe, to political conservatism and certainly not authoritarianism. As I suggested earlier, Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy is not a term I particularly like for a number of reasons. It is awkward, it is too technical, and it relies too heavily upon the Protestant-Mormon analogy. In other words, to the theologian, it connotes too much. To the layperson, it connotes too little. But my most fundamental objection is that I question whether Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy is a specifically theological movement at all. Not that there are not theological differences. Neo-Orthodox Mormonism and Progressive Mormonism surely differ in their assessment of human nature. Without denying the doctrines commonly associated with the King Follett discourse, Neo-Orthodox Mormons accept the scriptural description of man's fallen state and the moral and spiritual entropy of humanity. In contrast, Progressive Mormons hold that man is essentially good, a conclusion seen as following necessarily from the eternal nature of the human intelligence and the teaching that humans are gods in embryo. Progressive Mormonism either ignores the fallen nature scriptures in the Book of Mormon or rejects them as eclipsed by the Nauvoo period. I also agree that Neo-Orthodox Mormonism and Progressive Mormonism differ on soteriology, the doctrine of salvation. Neo-Orthodox Mormons stress Christ as Savior, the necessity of human reliance upon His merits and power, and the ultimate futility of human works. In a word, grace. Progressive Mormonism tends to view Christ as exemplar rather than Savior, stressing spiritual progress through human effort and self-development. These are fundamental doctrinal differences with profound implications. However, on the third prong of White's tripartite test, the clear distinction between Neo-Orthodox and Progressive Mormonism blurs somewhat. Perhaps unlike Neo-Orthodox Protestants, few, if any, Neo-Orthodox Mormons believe that God created the world ex nihilo, that He is unrelated to and unconditioned by an environment, or that rather than being, He is being itself. And yet these are characteristic of an absolute God in the technical theological sense, and to a trained theologian, any God who cannot be described in these terms is non-absolute and finite. I think most, if not all, Neo-Orthodox Mormons would agree with progressives that God was once man, that He has a tangible body of flesh and bones, that He, or rather they, organized the earth out of eternally existent matter, and that human intelligence is co-eternal with God. Theologically, then, Neo-Orthodox Mormonism and Progressive Mormonism agree that God is, technically speaking, finite and non-absolute. There is admittedly a difference in the way Neo-Orthodox Mormons and Progressive Mormons describe God's attributes. Neo-Orthodox Mormons are probably more inclined to employ absolutist terms, such as infinite and omnipotent, descriptors which, while inaccurate while speaking within a larger theological or philosophical framework, are entirely accurate within a specifically Mormon context where everyone understands the ground rules. Thus, for Mormons, calling God omnipotent does not imply an ex nihilo creation or cosmogony, only that God has all the power possible within the universe described by Joseph Smith. For a Mormon, that is omnipotence. Being more attuned to theological jargon, Progressive Mormons favor calling such a God finite, and rather than all-powerful, most powerful. What I am describing is a semantic difference. The God who in Mormon vernacular or scriptural language is infinite and eternal is finite and time-bound in classical theological jargon. But to call the different semantic begs the question, why do the different schools favor the terminology they do? I believe the semantic difference reflects divergent soteriologies. Theocentric soteriology, which stresses man's dependence on God for mortal life and salvation, is more congenial to the language of absoluteness and the so-called omnis, omniscience, omnipresence, and omnipotence. For example, I am comfortable describing God as infinite and transcendent. In contrast, I think a good many progressive Mormons would like Mormonism to square its categories with the larger philosophical tradition and start talking about the finitude of God. But I don't believe the progressives' predilection for the language of finitude is explainable entirely by a respect for the integrity of language. Just as my choice of vocabulary is influenced by my soteriology, describing God as the most powerful and most knowledgeable among finite beings tacitly advances the anthropocentric progressive soteriology of personal merit and achievement. Also, neo-Orthodox Mormons and progressive Mormons could probably get into some arguments over secondary issues, such as the extent of God's knowledge and foreknowledge, the degree of dependence or independence or individuation of human intelligence before God's action upon it, the degree to which organized matter continues to depend upon God for its organization, and the extent to which God is subject to laws outside his control. I do not mean to imply that these are not interesting, substantive, even important issues. They are. But theologically speaking, they are decidedly secondary in comparison to the profound difference between Augustine's absolute God and the God of King Follett, however you choose to describe him. In short, Neo-Orthodox Mormonism and Progressive Mormonism are in essential agreement that God is not absolute, and their differences are either questions of degree or choices of vocabulary influenced by soteriology. White's trifold analogy to Protestant Neo-Orthodoxy thus breaks down on the question of the nature of God. While Protestantism includes proponents of both an absolute God and a finite God, Mormonism includes only the latter. For this reason, it appears to me that writers who attribute to Neo-Orthodoxy a belief in an absolute God have been misled by the Protestant analogy into creating a straw man. But by this conclusion, I don't mean to suggest that there is no difference between the Neo-Orthodox God and the progressive God. I just don't think it relates to issues of absoluteness or infinitude. White and others have attempted to describe the difference as theological, but it is not. It transcends theology. Let me illustrate what I mean with a few examples of different Mormons writing about God. Let's look first at some descriptions of God from progressive Mormons. Here is how Sterling McMurrin, author of the scholarly and influential Theological Foundations of the Mormon Religion, a book with a strong progressive bias, writes about God. God is described in non-absolutist terms as a being who is conditioned by and related to the world of which he is a part, and which, because it is not ultimately his creation, is not absolutely under his dominion. God is related to a world environment for the being of which he is not the ultimate ground, and by which he therefore is in some sense conditioned. This means that God is a being among beings, rather than being as such, or the ground of being, and that he is therefore finite, rather than absolute. In his article entitled The Mormon Concept of God, Blake Osler offers a similar description. In contrast to the static, timeless, and immutable being of scholasticism, the God of Mormon revelation is a dynamic being among beings involved in the process of time, who intervenes in history to bring order out of chaos and value out of discord. Another writer whom I would describe as a progressive Mormon, Mark Gustafson, describes the God of Mormonism as follows. God is an anthropomorphic deity with human but exalted passions and virtues. He is bound by a priori law and is, thankfully, unburdened by the responsibility for the ex nihilo creation of the universe. Mark, you never told us who we were supposed to be thankful to, though, that God didn't create the world ex nihilo. Moreover, the Mormon God is a proximate, comprehensible deity whose ends and means regarding mortal salvation can be adequately understood by virtuous human beings. Close quote. In his article, Omnis on the Horizon, Kent Robeson writes as follows about God. The Mormon view, then, is one of a God that has a body and spatial temporal location and can influence all things by his spirit. Robeson observes that for Mormons, the Omni words, quote, have an expansive and grandiose ring, close quote, and he ironically chides those who wax mystical on the ineffable and incommunicable grandeur and majesty of God. Yet what I find arresting is the near total absence in progressive Mormonism of this very sense of the grandeur and majesty of God. In fact, progressive Mormonism is nearly silent on the personality of God. By this, I do not mean the fact that God exhibits qualities of personhood, such as a physical body complete with parts and passions and so forth. I mean a sense of God as a particular person with particular passions. For this reason, progressive Mormonism, at least in its present state, is less an expression of the Mormon religion than it is a school of Mormon theology, promulgated most prominently by Mormon philosophers. In Selective Progressive Mormons, to quote earlier in this paper, I selected McMurrin because his expression of progressive Mormonism is both the most complete and the most influential. The others I selected because they are careful thinkers and articulate writers and because they have been the most active proponents of progressive Mormonism in the last two Sunstone Symposia and in Sunstone and Dialogue. It is simply coincidence that of these four writers, two, McMurrin and Robeson, are professional philosophers, and the others, Osler and Gustafson, hold bachelor's degrees in philosophy. I call it coincidence, but probably it is not. Whatever its provenance, progressive Mormonism is now being articulated largely by philosophers. In part, this is due to the fact that it takes a philosopher to appreciate its features. For example, progressive writers frequently bemoan Mormons' ignorance of the strength of their own theology, meaning its strength as a philosophical position. Thus, McMurrin observes that Mormon theologians, quote, have often failed to recognize the strength of their own position. He later stresses that this strength, quote, has never been fully exploited, however, for here again the Mormon theologians generally seem to be unaware of this advantage. Blake Osler echoes this regret, writing, quote, Mormons have rarely appreciated the strength of their doctrine of God, nor have they realized how essentially their view differs from Catholic/Protestant theology. But I wonder whether it is a failure to see or a failure to care. Religion is not about solving philosophical problems, no matter how profound or perplexing. You may say, as Gustafson has, that in the face of the problem of evil, we may be logically compelled to deny God any meaningful power at all. But in so doing, you are left with a being untrue to any scriptural description or any personal experience. I understand that the philosopher Mortimer Adler announced a logical proof demonstrating the existence of God, but simultaneously concluding that no knowledge of his qualities was possible. You cannot turn the world upside down with that. Progressive Mormonism's description of God in terms of theological categories contrasts sharply with neo-Orthodox descriptions of a personal God. Consider the following passage from Donald L. Olson. Those who continue in grace will someday stand before God, where Christ will plead their case, saying to the Father, I am their righteousness. I have paid justice for their sins. Then God will see only the good works of Christ and say to them, Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. This passage is theological. It expresses the crux of the doctrine of grace. But it is more than that. The scene of Christ pleading the sinner's cause after having paid for their sins with his life, and the ultimate love that act implies, imbues the passage with a passion and poignancy. Here is another description of Christ from a 1986 paper of mine. Rather than bet on my own works, I will take a chance on a village carpenter, who seemed to prefer the company of women and fishermen to priests and politicians, who is a hero to the lame and the halt, and a villain to the well-heeled and well-placed, a carpenter who is executed like a criminal for claiming he was God. Because then, as you know, it turned out that he was. An even more direct expression of belief is the following statement by Margaret Toscano from her essay Beyond Matriarchy, Beyond Patriarchy. At a time of crisis in my own life, I experienced the love and power of Jesus Christ in such a way that I cannot reject him as Savior, nor can I be ambiguous about his divinity or his identity as God. Again, although her assertion of the divinity of Christ is doctrinal, what predominates is the statement of personal discipleship implied by the words, I cannot reject him. An evocative reversal of Isaiah 53:3, he was despised and rejected of men. The believer's search for and relationship to God is a recurrent theme in neo-Orthodox writing. The following statement from Don Luthayer is a good example. Though it is not an attempt to describe God, it conveys much about his personality as perceived by the writer. So while this life is not simple, the yoke of Christ is easy and his burden is light. Wandering then I listen for his call, so that I do not fear too much and lose the way. Shepherd, king, bridegroom, host, mother, father, friend. He calls in many voices, all one voice. He calls and waits that I should hear and come. In contrast to what one might predict from White's book, Neo-Orthodox Mormonism often coexists with a strong interest in feminist theology. A good example of this interest, is Janice Allred's description of the feminine pole of Christ's personality. When Jesus said from the cross, Woman, behold thy son, He was asking us to behold him as immortal, born into this world through the love of a woman and the sacrifice of her body. When he said, "Behold thy mother," he was asking us to behold him as our mother, through love, sacrificing his life to bring us into the eternal world. Again, the passage is clearly theological, but it is primarily and essentially religious. It is the disciples' voice, not the theologians, that we hear. The neo-Orthodox response to the problem of evil shows a similar preference for the person of God over theological constructions. Daniel Rector responded to Mark Gustafson's paper entitled, "Is the God of Neo-Orthodoxy Evil?" In that response, he quoted the following passage from Tony Hutchinson. "The image of a brutally executed Galilean, prophet or not, pales beside the vast panorama of human suffering, writ large, bitter, and overwhelming. But the panorama dims and shrinks in the stark light of the haunting image of God, not a member of some science fiction LDS corporation of the presidency of the galaxy, but of God upon the cross." Multiply your philosophical proofs if you care to, but you will never persuade someone for whom that God is a reality, to whom that passage speaks, that his God is evil. Finally, I know of no better expression of the passion for God to which neo-orthodoxy is so congenial and progressive Mormonism so indifferent than the following passage from Paul Toscano. "God, who could have insulated himself from pain, descended to earth, assumed the aspect of his children, and bore the greatest pain in his own person. Rather than hoard the heavenly feast for himself, he invites beggars to his table. He breaks bread with us and drinks from the cup our lips have touched. When he speaks to us, it is no longer from a great white throne centered in a vortex of light, surrounded by celestial griffins warding off the unwashed. He speaks to us eye to eye from a traitor's gibbet, with his blood and sweat and shame upon him for all to see, and with his wounds forever open. He comes not as king, but as slave. He comes not as judge, but as accused. He comes not as patriarch, but as bastard. He comes not to punish us, but to let us punish him. He does not ask us to love him until we are first certain that he loves us. He is the great failure who saves us from our success. He is the great fool who spares us from our wisdom. He is the rejected lover who will not, in turn, reject his love. He is a prophet without honor, a citizen of a despised nation, a poor relation, an unwanted guest. He is the voice of one crying in the wilderness of every human heart. He is the God of grief and sorrow, who is the joy of our desiring." The rhetorical power of this passage exceeds most, if not all, neo-Orthodox statements, and far exceeds any progressive statements about God that I have read. But the rhetoric is not artifice. It is the overflowing of a passion, not for the concept of God or the strength of the Mormon concept of God, but for the person of God. It might be argued that I have stacked the deck by choosing neo-Orthodox quotes about Jesus, whose personhood and personality are obviously far more accessible than those of God the Father, of whom we know so little, hardly more, I should say, than we know of God the Mother. My response is twofold. First, Jesus Christ is the God of Neo-Orthodoxy. Neo-Orthodox soteriology revolves around Christ as Savior. We are saved by virtue of his gracious act of atoning for our sins. When Neo-Orthodox writers speak of God, they generally mean Jesus. In contrast, progressive Mormonism, which stresses our godly pedigree, tends to focus on our heavenly parent, God the Father. It is by virtue of our divine parentage that we claim a divine inheritance. Second, even when progressive writers treat Jesus, they often show little passion for his person. These excerpts from Keith Norman's article, "Toward a Mormon Christology," is illustrative. Christ's role is not to let us off the hook, but to show us that it is possible to achieve holiness, to become perfect as God is perfect, to demonstrate how to do it, and to motivate us to follow his example. "One of our fellow men has overcome every obstacle, including guilt and estrangement, and realized the full potential of our divine humanity. Knowing this truth makes us free to do likewise." Another quote, "It would be more appropriate to relate to Jesus as the older brother we proclaim him to be, a sympathetic, experienced mentor, tolerant of our growing pains because he has been there and knows that with careful, loving guidance, we will outgrow this stage too." Norman sees in Mormonism the subordination of Christology to anthropology, the doctrine of man. He approvingly cites Elder McConkie's condemnation of the so-called gospel fad of striving to develop a personal relationship with Christ. Finally, he repeats the gentle but familiar reproof that Mormonism has an important contribution to make in the area of Christology, though we scarcely are even aware of it. Thus, the fundamental difference I see between Neo-Orthodox Mormonism and Progressive Mormonism does not hinge on theological distinctions regarding God's attributes. To say that is to put the question in strictly progressive terms. The real difference lies in the two schools' respective preoccupations. For Progressive Mormonism, it is the theology of God. For Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy, it is the personality of God. Before I continue, let me briefly digress to stress one caveat. And if I thought that you would not understand this, I would never have undertaken to give this paper. I would be greatly distressed if anyone made the mistake of inferring that I believe that you can judge the depth or sincerity of a person's faith or commitment or obedience by whether he or she is progressive or neo-orthodox. You cannot do it. And it would be very, very wrong to try. Like patriotism in the political realm, these things cut across party lines. I have no doubt that you could translate most of the neo-orthodox passages I have quoted into a series of theological propositions consistent with progressive Mormon theology. Most, not all. But in doing so, you would distill out of them the passion that conveys a sense of the personality of God and the adoration of the disciple. And with it, you would distill out much of the truth. That is because, while the attributes of God may be rationally articulated, the full truth of the nature of God, such as we can experience it, cannot be trapped in a series of philosophical propositions. Trying to discover God through theology is like dissecting a cat to see what makes it so endearing. Inner truths are often impervious to reason. As Malcolm Muggeridge writes, only mystics, clowns, and artists, in my experience, speak the truth. Which, as Blake, William, not Osler, was always insisting, is perceptible to the imagination rather than the mind. I am afraid such talk exasperates my progressive Mormon friends. But I believe many Neo-Orthodox Mormons would see truth in it, as they might this poem by Walt Whitman. When I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon, unaccountable, I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself in the mystical moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars. Now, I know this poem because I, like four of the other seven Neo-Orthodox writers I have quoted, majored in English, which I allow may say something about Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy. If we draw the conclusion on one side, we ought to be willing to look at it on the other as well. And even as I quote it, I well know that my progressive Mormon friends, if they had been reading Whitman and Yeats in school instead of Pelagius and Augustine, would say to me, so you're quoting Whitman on the subject of truth, the very poet who elsewhere wrote, do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself. And I think that is the chief charge currently leveled against Neo-Orthodox Mormonism by the progressives. You don't make sense. You don't attend to the logical implications of your assertions. You lack intellectual integrity. This I am not willing to concede. Surprise. Neo-Orthodox Mormons have never said, nor do any that I know believe, that theology is unimportant. Janice didn't say that yesterday, did she?
No.
I wouldn't classify Jean as a Neo-Orthodox Mormon. On the contrary, many have attempted and will continue to attempt to articulate and defend their theology. And while Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy has perhaps given too little attention to its theological ramifications, the intellectual contributions of the current crop of Neo-Orthodox writers is impressive. Their critiques of the institution have been insightful. Witness Aaron Silva's paper last session. Their critiques, their explorations of Joseph's thought have ranged far beyond the King Follett discourse, whatever its merits. They have exposed the legalism and naive optimism about human nature, which progressive Mormonism in its popular forms unavoidably fosters, and have offered an alternative doctrine of man. Finally, they have led the way in explicating the feminine in Mormon theology, a far more intellectually challenging task than merely demanding the priesthood for women, however much courage doing so may require. And yet, I do know what they mean. Squaring the sum seems to mean more to them than to us. For us, it is secondary. Biology is important, but it is not as important as bios. Theology is important, but the main thing is theos. I return to Mark's provocative argument that the God of Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy is evil. If you assert that God is all-powerful and therefore able to prevent all evil, you must admit the reality, and you admit the reality of evil, you must live the result. Your God is himself evil for allowing the sea of evil around us. In other words, given the inconsistency, at least as Mark sees it, of God's goodness, God's power, and evil, Mark accuses Neo-Orthodoxy of forfeiting God's goodness to reconcile the trilemma. Mark seems to reconcile it by forfeiting God's power. My purpose is not to critique his method or his conclusion, but to observe his apparent willingness to radically depart from the God of the Scriptures or even the Nauvoo period in order to resolve a philosophical conundrum. I doubt that any Neo-Orthodox Mormon is willing to do this. Daniel Rector's response to Mark is instructive. He writes, "On this point, I think he has got us." What? A concession that God is evil? Of course not, and especially not when the only other choice is an impotent God. For me, Daniel writes, it is more satisfying to believe in a God who shouldered the blame for the evil in the world and who drank the bitter cup of sin's consequences to its dregs than to believe in a God who is so impotent that he cannot enter the world to save it. You see, Neo-Orthodoxy posits the goodness of God and approaches the question from that premise. Would a God who is evil have stepped down from the comfort of his heavenly throne and entered his own creation as a weak and helpless baby? Would a God who is evil have wept as he stood before the grave of his friend Lazarus, even knowing that he was about to raise him? Would a God who is evil have forgiven the prostitute and invited those of her accusers who were without sin to cast the first stone at her? Would a God who is evil have allowed himself to be stripped naked, beaten, taunted, and nailed to a cross for our sakes? If solving the riddle of evil entails that God is evil, there is something wrong either with the riddle or with the solution. Ideally, reason will discover the flaw. If not, we continue to believe, as G.K. Chesterton wrote, that the riddles of God are more satisfying than the solutions of men. In 1842, Joseph Smith posed a similar conundrum to the Nauvoo Relief Society, where you don't hear many conundrums posed nowadays, do you? Do you think, he asked, that even Jesus, if he were here, would be without fault in your eyes? His apparent intent was doubtless to quell criticism, pointing out that nobody's perfect, so to speak, even someone who is. But his question tantalizes. To begin with, it is leading. We would, he suggests, see faults in Jesus himself. One might therefore reason as follows. God is by definition wholly good and without fault. Jesus has faults. Ergo, Jesus is not God. But the gist of Joseph's comment is not that Jesus in fact has faults, but that his goodness so transcends our moral sense that his virtues would appear to us as vices. This willingness to believe that an apparently flawed man is God introduces an element of doubt into all logical and moral conclusions about God. Perhaps Neo-Orthodox Mormonism is more willing than Progressive Mormonism to take this step. I say more willing because belief in any God whatsoever ultimately is a non-rational act. For Neo-Orthodox Mormonism, indeed for Mormonism in general, the nature and personality of God are far, far, foremost matters of faith, scriptural truth, and personal experience. This is the God of whom Sterling McMurrin wrote, "The personal concept of God set forth in the Hebrew Scriptures is not the result of metaphysical or theological speculation or disputation. It is rather the product of a sense of living involvement with a God who more than anything else is the sovereign of the moral law and the Lord of history." Personal commitment to this God is strongly expressed in Mormon Neo-Orthodox writing. Many Neo-Orthodox Mormons would, I believe, resonate with this passage from a letter written by Dostoevsky. "If anyone could prove to me that Christ is outside the truth, and if the truth really did exclude Christ, I should prefer to stay with Christ and not with the truth." To progressive Mormonism, I suspect Dostoevsky's apparently irrational affirmation of loyalty would appear to be simply another example of not making sense. And perhaps this is the nub of the difference. Progressive Mormonism speaks in syllogisms. Neo-Orthodox Mormonism speaks in poetry. Progressive Mormonism would define God. Neo-Orthodox Mormonism would embrace him. Progressive Mormonism shows us God's attributes. Neo-Orthodox Mormonism shows us God's wounds. Progressive Mormonism exalts in the man who became God. Neo-Orthodox Mormonism exalts in the God who became man. Progressive Mormonism wants a God finite enough to solve the problem of cosmic evil. Neo-Orthodox Mormonism wants a God infinite enough to solve the problem of personal sin. Progressive Mormonism wants a God who makes sense. Neo-Orthodox Mormonism wants a God who makes love. I will close with a passage from Sterling McMurrin's Theological Foundations. "It was the living, existential God, not the conceptual God of the philosophers and theologians, of whom Isaiah cried, 'For mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts,' of whom Jeremiah declared, 'But the Lord is the true God. He is the living God. At his wrath the earth shall tremble, and the nations shall not be able to abide his indignation.' This is not the God of the philosophers," continuing to quote McMurrin, "however much they may wonder on the mystery of things, for their God is a principle of rational explanation. They know of him, but they cannot encounter him. It is not the God of the theologians, for the theologians lay the veneer of their life-destroying intellect over everything they touch. This is, rather, the God of religion. When we ask the question of whether God is a person, it is here, and only here, that the crucial issue lies." In sum, I believe it is what McMurrin calls the God of religion that Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy is trying to express. In so doing, it does not offer a distinctive doctrine of God at all. What it does offer is a grasp of the personality of God, a sense of God's love and sacrifice for each of us, and therefore a reason to return his love. And for me, at any rate, that makes all the difference.
My emotional response to reading this paper was kaleidoscopic. I was angry, then I was amused. After a second reading, I experienced a twinge of fear. After a third reading, more than anything, I was bemused. I think by now I've settled into amusement and bemusement with lingering shades of anger. The title of this paper suggests that it offers a substantive discussion of two schools of thought which have emerged from the ongoing development of the theology which undergirds Mormon faith. The focal point of the discussion, again as promised by the title, is the personality of God. From my point of view, any similarities between the title and the contents of this paper are purely coincidental. The paper does not offer a careful treatment of the differing views of the personality of God, as promulgated by the so-called progressive and so-called neo-orthodox groups within the Mormon community. This paper, in fact, is fashioned as a tract which claims superiority for the religious sensibilities of those who espouse the neo-orthodox point of view. It seems embarrassingly obvious to me that the author is claiming the necessary discernment and the right to pronounce judgment on the religious fervor and spiritual maturity, or more accurately, on the lack of such, of those who espouse what he calls the progressive point of view. Let me illustrate by citing key passages from the paper. What I find arresting, quoting, is the near total absence in progressive Mormonism of this sense of the grandeur and majesty of God. Progressive Mormonism, at least in its present state, is less an expression of Mormon religion than it is a school of Mormon theology. Quoting Donald Olson, those who continue in grace will someday stand before God where Christ will plead their case, saying to the Father, I am their righteousness, I have paid justice for their sins. Then God will see only the good works of Christ and say to them, enter into the joy of thy Lord. Comment concerning that passage. This is a doctrinal passage that expresses the crux of the doctrine of grace, but it is more than that. The scene of Christ pleading the sinner's cause after having paid for their sins with his life imbues the passage with passion and poignancy almost entirely absent from progressive Mormon writings. This then is the fundamental difference between neo-orthodox Mormonism and progressive Mormonism. Only is the word neo-orthodox Mormonism projects a sense of the personality of God. I mean this both in the sense that God is a particular person and in the sense that he is a particular personality. And only neo-orthodoxy is willing to explore the disciples' relationship with God, subject given scant, if any attention in progressive texts. Reason is the servant of faith and not the master. Neo-Orthodox Mormons are defending their theology with the tools of reason. Neo-Orthodox Mormons are disciples. Progressives are students. I think it is primarily because Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy is a religious movement based on personal religious experience, whereas progressive Mormonism is primarily theological and philosophical. It is this difference which accounts for the passion for God, in the sense of his person, that seems to be present in one and not in the other. I believe that the God of Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy is the God of religion. Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy does not offer a new concept of God at all. What it does offer is a clear grasp of the personality of Christ, a sense of God's passion for each mortal, and so on. One point in reading this paper, particularly the portions I've just alluded to, quoted from, an image from an old movie popped into my mind. Some of you might remember the scene from the movie 10. Had an R rating, you may not have gone. Where Dudley Moore is skipping and hopping across the sand of a very hot beach. Remember that scene? The sand would burn his feet if he stood in one place even for a moment. He's therefore forced to skip and hop until he finally arrives at the safety and relative cool of his blanket. I see that scene as a kind of metaphor for how Fred has fashioned this paper. He seems willing to play loose with the demands of consistency, coherence and fairness as he hops over hot or difficult, sometimes agonizing issues until he finally settles on a safe blanket of the claim that the truth of the neo-orthodox position is clearly demonstrated by the obvious superiority of the spiritual sensitivities of its proponents. One hesitates to dignify such a claim with a response, but since clearly defined positions to which one can respond are hard to find in this paper, let me spend a moment and remind Fred of something I know he knows. A passionate, heartfelt utterance is not limited to a particular theological stance. I know he went to great lengths to deny that that, in fact, is what he was saying, but he said it and then denied it. You drop more than one name, Fred. Let me drop two or three. What about the poignant pleas of Olol Benyon for the good works of service? What about the deeply felt invitations toward God-centered, productive living from Ehud Brown? What about B.H. Roberts' passionate defense of his God, of his personal experience with his God? By your own criteria, I would guess that you might agree that these are pretty good representatives of so-called progressive Mormon thought. Incredibly, when Fred allows himself to acknowledge passion or a sense of experiential religion or the importance of such from the writings of progressive Mormons, he deftly appropriates such writings for his own team. For example, he quotes McMurrin as follows: "The personal concept of God set forth in the Hebrew Scriptures is not the result of metaphysical or theological speculation or disputation. It is rather the product or a sense of living involvement with God, who more than anything else is the sovereign of the moral law and the Lord of history." He introduces McMurrin's words with this statement: "Sterling McMurrin might have been speaking of Mormon neo-orthodoxy." Incredible. And when he quotes, finished the quote, he follows with this comment: "Thus, it may well be that Mormon neo-orthodoxy, being fundamentally experiential rather than rational, has more confidence in its experience of God than in reason." What makes Fred's effort to appropriate McMurrin's words so laughable is that he pulls them out of a piece of writing wherein McMurrin is making the point that the underlying metaphysics of the theological stance Fred refers to as progressive Mormonism is crucial to a sense of and relationship with a personal God. But this brings me to what I regard to be one of the serious flaws in the neo-orthodox position. I refer to the tendency to reduce important and challenging and sometimes gut-wrenchingly difficult issues to simple either-or choices. Reason versus faith, experiential versus rational, grace versus works, power of God versus human autonomy, religion versus theology. For example, Fred comments, "It seems to me that to believe in any God whatsoever is a non-rational act." Why? Why is it non-rational? Why is it not more than rational? It is fascinating to note that sometimes this either-or thinking can, for neo-orthodox, come very close to either Christ or God the Father, which I believe in an interesting kind of way was precisely the concern of one Bruce McConkie on one occasion, and those of you who know me know that I'm not a great defender of Bruce McConkie. At one point in his paper, Fred asserts, "When neo-orthodox writers speak of God, they generally mean Jesus. And then even more emphatically, Jesus Christ is the God of neo-orthodoxy." With regard to the doctrine of salvation, Fred makes this comment: "Neo-orthodox Mormons stress Christ as Savior, the necessity of human reliance upon his merits and power, and the ultimate futility of human works, in a word, grace, Progressive Mormons tend to view Christ as exemplar rather than Savior, stressing spiritual progress through human effort and self-development. Why do we need to choose, Brad? If you say we don't, then most of what you and your fellows say about the doctrine of salvation is misguided and obsessive. Obsessive focus on one aspect of reality always becomes a flawed lens, which either distorts or blacks out other essential aspects of reality. One can become dangerously comfortable with such a lens. After all, either-or thinking can become a kind of refuge from difficult issues, something like the blanket spread over the hot sand on the beach. Seems to me that a fundamental characteristic of the spiritually mature is his/her acceptance of the creative tension. I emphasize both creative tension, which results from the effort to bring so-called complementary opposites into workable harmony. Our problem, and I say our problem, all of us, I believe, is a tendency to succumb to the notion of a kind of linear or single cause sense of causality. Rather than seeing causality emerge from a systemic structure, we are conditioned to see life as a series of events. And for every event, we suppose there is an obvious cause. One, salvation is not an event which results from a single cause. It is rather a process which emerges from the interplay of a number of forces. It seems to me that the neo-Orthodox see grace as a causation that unilaterally determines the outcome, which they call salvation. The alternative view is that grace refers to a power which does not and cannot unilaterally determine the outcome, but only influence it. The outcome must be determined by the recipient of the freely bestowed gift. We haven't time to deal with the finer points of the doctrine of salvation. My point is that if there really is a theological movement which focuses exclusively on grace, and another movement which focuses almost exclusively on works, I say pox on both of your houses. My own bias suggests that the neo-Orthodox seem more prone to fall into this either-or trap. I really doubt that any informed, responsible observer would ever charge that the progressive Mormon position rejects the notion of grace. What seems to disturb the neo-Orthodox is that we affirm grace and the works of human autonomy. I have here a book by an author who is not well-known anymore. His name is Nephi Jensen. Interesting collection of out-of-print essays. I'm intrigued by this author because I see him striving to give expression to a kind of theological synergistic sense of we have to have the whole load of hay. A wonderful collection of essays in that regard. And from my description, you'll not ever read the book, but read it and you'll, I think, sense what I'm talking about. What seems to me to give the neo-Orthodox position their particular flavor hinges again on the issue of human autonomy. One other quick note in passing. Fred makes reference to an interesting experience in Las Vegas which exonerated him from the charge of being Calvinistic. I totally agree that he does not qualify. Calvin was nothing if he was not consistent, and I believe this paper manifests a serious lack of consistency on Fred's part. While claiming to accept doctrines commonly associated with the King Follett sermon, Fred gravitates toward spiritual interpretations, particularly with regard to the process of salvation, which deny such doctrines. Fred charges that progressive Mormons either ignore the fallen nature, scriptures in the Book of Mormon, or reject them as eclipsed by King Follett. Here we are at another either-or, the Book of Mormon or King Follett. My theology does not require me to choose. We do not deny the so-called fallen nature scriptures. We simply affirm such scriptures do not negate human autonomy. We do not teach the man is innately evil, nor do we teach that he is innately good. We teach that he is innately free. What we affirm is that there is another, obviously he has both tendencies, man, pardon me, good, evil, but understanding, undergirding them, is the eternal capacity to choose. In closing, here is a passionate statement from a so-called progressive Mormon to a so-called New Orthodox Mormon. I can and do express, Fred, to you genuine feelings of love and goodwill, but I have an intense dislike of what you have said. Let's see now, would that be a theological or religious statement? My point is, I don't have to choose. Thank you.
Thank you. Fred has requested another minute here, and I think I'm going to give him that.
You didn't recognize some of the passages that Carlyle quoted in his response. It's not because I didn't write them. It's because I didn't read them. Or I substantially edited them before I read them, for the very reason that he mentioned. The fact that I would cause such offense, had I known it before I gave the paper, would have caused me never to have given the paper. And let me apologize to Carlyle for that offense, and the fact that he felt it suggests to me that probably Blake and Mark felt it even more strongly. And if in fact that is true, I certainly would plead for their forgiveness for the offense, because it was not intended. I don't mean to suggest they feel no passion. I certainly do not believe that. Nor do I mean to suggest that Neo-Orthodoxy or Neo-Orthodox Mormons have a corner on God. I don't believe that either. I think progressive Mormons and Neo-Orthodox Mormons, and I think there some generalizations are possible. Maybe I disagree with Carlyle on that. Are both struggling toward an understanding of God, and they're struggling in different ways. And those ways that they are struggling manifest themselves differently in their writings. And that's what I tried to portray in my paper. I guess oftentimes we want to amuse others. We don't generally aren't generally pleased when we amuse them without intending to, as I apparently have done with Carlyle and maybe for many of you. But let me say that I have never been bemused by the writings of Sterling McMurrin, Mark Gustafson, Blake Osler, Kent Robeson. Maybe slightly angered once or twice by McMurrin in particular. Certainly never by the ones I know better. But it was not my intention to undertake any sort of process that did not involve total mutual respect among the participants. And I have apparently stumbled outside the scope within which I tried to remain. And for that, all I can say is, I'm sorry.
Well, I'm Blake Osler. I'm a person who's supposed to be offended, I think. I'm not offended. One of the problems with passion is that it can get out of hand. By its very nature, I think it's supposed to do that now and then. And in my life, it's a wonderful thing when it happens. For those of you who are acquainted with my writings, you might think I spend my whole life avoiding passion. I try to be objective, and there's a good deal to be said for passion and non-passion. What happens when you have a mixing of discourse, a mixing, I believe, of rhetoric and logic, is that the two often don't get along very well together. Reason is very jealous of its territory, doesn't like somebody saying, look, what I'm doing is beyond where you can reach. Because when people are allowed to get unreasonable, anything goes. And maybe that's what passion wants to say. But even passion must be kept within the bounds that the Lord has set. And the reality here is that I don't think what Fred is describing is really much of a difference between